You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 10, thank you so much for staying with us. This is the second hour of the show. I'm hoping this might become a feature. It's my proposal if you enjoy it. It's fascinating. I think sometimes as South Africans, we're very parochial, and foreign correspondents who have to file copy for the rest of the world, I think, have an interesting perspective of the place that they are filing from to the rest of the universe. And so we thought what we'd do is to bring in a couple of foreign correspondents and just have a chat about what it is that is on their diaries, about the country, about the region, and their conversations that they have with their colleagues elsewhere in the world, trying to get certain stories out there, what is of interest to their colleagues, readers, viewers around the world, and what is not. And two folks that I have in the studio, I love to bits. One is Deborah Patter, who is CBS News foreign correspondent. Deborah, it's lovely to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's good to be back here.
And someone else, I'm so glad. The last time I saw, we were partying up a storm in Braamfontein.
Don't give Aaron secrets away.
Aaron Conway-Smith, foreign correspondent for The Economist. Aaron, thank you so much for coming in.
Hi,
as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Deborah, I want to start firstly with you. Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated. What has changed for you filing stories for a South African audience, for a South African media house? Mm. Obviously, you're still very South African, but what has it meant for you in terms of your orientation as a journalist, now being a correspondent, filing for abroad, for over the seas?
Such a great question, Eusebius. Actually, it's rekindled my love for journalism, because I think partly it was my own situation. I'd been in one thing for so long doing third degree that, you know, you get into a comfort zone. Mm. And now I've been challenged. The bar's really high. And you're not just testing your skills in a country that you know. You should be a decent journalist in South Africa if you've been here long enough. But elsewhere around the globe, on the continent. And so from that point of view, it sort of reminded me of why I love being a journalist. And to be frank, it's actually been a bit of a relief to have a break from South Africa's politics. Mm. Because it's exhausting. This country is an exhausting place sometimes. But I think perhaps the biggest and most significant change, and it's a damning indictment on us as South African media, is that I have done far more African stories since working for CBS News than I ever did working for a single South African media outlet. We are myopic. We're very parochial. We think we're the most important story. And you get out there and really the rest of the world actually doesn't care that much about South Africa anymore.
Is resource differences at all a mitigating factor, or are we just parochial in our newsrooms?
I think resource is a factor. Okay. It's expensive to travel. And so when you work for a big outlet, you have the backing. If they go for a story, they go for it and they pay and they protect you, because protection is a huge issue. If you go into Syria, for example, someone just got kidnapped there. So obviously those are issues, but I think it's also we don't understand. We don't know. And Africa should be on our minds. Even if we don't get to African countries, we can get fixes and stringers in those countries.
Absolutely.
We just don't care. We're not interested. And when you go to other African countries, I was in Rwanda, last year doing a fabulous story, really a beautiful story about this continent, about drone technology being used to send blood to people who desperately need it. Beautiful story.
Wow.
And they were really knowledgeable about South Africa. They knew all about President Zuma, as they knew about President, well, that's that he was campaigning to be President Trump.
Yeah.
And I thought, we don't do that in this country.
Mm, that's absolutely right. Aaron, when I used to write for the New York Times, I used to, with some, you know, grudgingly who tweet a link or put it on Facebook, because South Africans know this place so intimately that they judge you differently when you file for an international audience. But for an international audience, there's a certain level of granularity that will just make the copy incomprehensible. And I had a bit of relief no longer writing for them and being back on a sort of local beat full time, partly because in 800 words, for example, I would have a New York Times editor who's nerdish, who want to have their cake and eat it. They want context, they want everything else, but they also want it to be so lucid that someone who's got a vague interest in the continent can follow it, but that then won't get lost in the detail. And without fail, I would have South African readers going, oh, but you've undersold us. There's detail that's missing. How hard is it when you've been in a place for so long as you've been and you understand the texture, but when you file the copy, you know that you've got to pare down?
You're exactly right about that, that description. I mean, that's my struggle, pretty much. I mean, you know, you could write an entire story that's just background to what the story is. I mean, trying to explain the Guptas or something to an international audience that has no context as to who these people are. How do you make something that's going to be interesting give analysis and context to a readership that may or may not know anything about South Africa? That's the challenge. And yeah, I know. I know exactly that feeling that you describe. And it's a frustration. But my job is to try to explain this place in for an international readership. So I have to kind of keep that reader at the forefront while trying to put in things that hopefully will give some kind of insight, or maybe put it, shed a different perspective on something for a South African readership as well.
I want to talk about some of the issues that are foremost on your minds and your diaries as professionals, and I'd ask them to share that with us beforehand. I'll start with you, Erin. The first issue that you identify that we can chat a little bit about, you, me and Deborah, is South Africa and the ICC. How is that story playing out? I mean, a little bit on our open line. It's amazing. It's the one issue where South Africans are probably divided, not along party or racial lines, because the ICC is up for moral scrutiny, and I wonder what the interest of the rest of the world is in South Africa's decision.
Well, I think this is one of those stories that is a South African story that does have global significance. And I think that a lot of people are looking at South Africa and wondering how this is going to play out. I mean, you talk about if you're wondering about what the rest of the world sort of thinks of South Africa, I think this is a really good example. South Africa had been very strong in joining this court, and under Mandela was very strong about making human rights at the center of its foreign policy. Now that seems to have shifted. What's going to happen here? We now have a chance for South Africa to perhaps revisit its decision. I mean, it should be interesting to see what happens next month when South African officials are sort of hauled before The Hague to sort of explain why they failed to arrest Bashir when he was in South Africa in 2015 for the AU summit. But I think that South Africa's approach to the ICC sort of speaks to its, changing foreign policy, but also how it's viewed overseas, is South Africa sort of shedding its moral authority that it sort of has had. And yeah, I think it's a really important one to watch how this plays out.
Deborah, your take?
Moral authority is the real issue here, because South Africa didn't fail to arrest Bashir because he was, because they were against the ICC. It's a human rights issue, and this is a country that is founded on human rights. We fought for human rights during apartheid. Our values are supposed to be embedded in a human rights culture. We have one of the finest constitutions in the world, and that is how people judge this country. It's like, oh, well, you're now abandoning your adherence to human rights values. And I think that is really the problem, and why people judge it. I mean, I work for an American company, and America isn't even a signatory, so they're rich. They can't really talk about this particular issue. But I think South Africa is looked differently. Do they hold any moral authority in this continent? And I think the answer is no, they do not. They've squandered every bit of credit that they had.
Are your colleagues at CBS, are your viewers, do they care about this particular story or
this
not?
Particular one, they don't, because the ICC doesn't resonate. And I understand the issues why people are critical of the ICC, because there is a lot of hypocrisy involved in how we hold world leaders to account. But if you have nothing, then there is no recourse. If you are a victim of human rights in Sudan, is there ever going to be any recourse for what has been done to you?
One local story that you are watching closely is the SASA debacle. I cannot imagine that that's of any interest to your audience, or it's just for you. What is an active South African keeping tabs on that story?
No, it's of interest long term. The interest in South Africa comes and goes depending. So, for example, when there was all the issues around Zuma violating the constitution, it wasn't the nitty-gritty of it. It is what the long-term implications are for a country that the world was fascinated with. We were clearing out our cupboards because we might move offices. And literally in the 80s, 90s, if someone sneezed here, my colleague Nikki was saying at work, we would be covering it. Now it's like, really, it's desperate. Something dramatic will have to happen with Zuma. If Zuma went, for example, maybe they'd be interested. interested. Mm. But the Sasser one is an interesting to watch because I think it has long-term ramifications. It's not just about whether their payouts on the 1st of April. It's everything around it. And I think the ANC will look back in 2019. And if depending on how this pans out, this could be more than any other issue, the turning point for what their results are in that election.
You know, it's funny you should say that. The one thing I do enjoy when I give comment on an international platform like a CNN or like yours is that it forces you to ask the question that print editors often ask very nicely of their journalists. We don't do it enough, I think, in broadcasting, which is, what is the so what? You know, a horrible question grammatically, but we know what they mean. What is the so what? And it forces you to tease out the link between the minutiae and the overall issues. And you're right, everything here from South Africa's overall stability, the social security literally, and not just social security grants, the factional battles in the ANC, this is just another turf war. It's a proxy battle. So it certainly does matter as one of the lightning
the key,
rods.
Exactly. Yes. And who are they going to blame this crisis on? Mm. They can't blame it on white minority capital. I mean, the people that they're in bed with, Sasser, is the epitome of white minority capital. They can't blame it on the media, even though they're trying. And they can't blame it on apartheid because there were no social grants then.
Absolutely. I'm looking to see when paid Twitter is going to start calling Chief Justice Mogoeng Mogoeng a part of white monopoly capital now that he's demanded some answers. It is 17 minutes after 10. This is, I'm sort of already calling it our first Foreign Correspondence Corner. And we've got Deborah Petter, CBS News Foreign Correspondent, and Aaron Conway-Smith, Foreign Correspondent for The Economist, with us. And it's always fascinating to hear what is on the diary of those who have to have a wider lens than the ones that we sometimes use on local stories. If you want to engage them, you've got a question for them, give us a call, 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567.
Eusebius is on Twitter, at Eusebius.
21 minutes after 10, we've got a couple of foreign correspondents with me in the studio. Deborah, the famine on this continent, that's a big story. It ought to be a big story, but I sometimes feel like, I don't know whether people have famine fatigue or whether it's part of our own Afro-racism or whatever one want to call it. It just doesn't seem to elicit the same kind of interest as it ought to. Have you had much space to be able to cover it?
It's a huge issue, and it's something that, I mean, it's certainly we've been trying to get into various places. You've got northern Nigeria, in Maiduguri and beyond, and South Sudan, and now Somalia as well. And you have to understand that it takes the UN a very long time to declare an area a famine area. It's not a label they use easily. Hmm. It's quite a harsh determination. So to declare famine in South Sudan is a big deal. I think why this story should be important and why we're interested in it, it's not just famine caused by drought, it's man-made. This is a man-made famine. It's conflict that is preventing food from getting to people. So people are being starved to death by the fact that there is this raging civil war in South Sudan, the youngest nation they always like to bill it, which kind of fell back into civil war a couple of years after it began. And I think that's why it is something that is not just worthy of our attention, but we have a moral obligation to be covering it.
Have you had a chance to go to any of these regions?
We've just got our visas. I think we're about to get our visas. Mm. I'm hoping, if you're listening, South Sudan, we're waiting for our visas.
So you'll be going to South Sudan?
We're hoping to go there, yeah. It's a complicated trip because it's dangerous. It's not just famine. There's war, there's different factions and so on. So it requires a lot of planning and logistics, but that is where we're
going. Can we talk a little bit about that before we talk about Bob next door? Aaron, the war, going to these kind of war-torn areas and stuff, I mean, that's a particular kind of skill. Being just a good journalist can't be enough. What sort of training, what sort of protection typically do you get, if you can tell?
Well, we go on hostile environment training. We have to go.
What does that mean?
So basically, they simulate you getting kidnapped. They simulate you in hostile environments.
Jeez.
I wasn't very good. I think I failed the kid. I don't like things over my head. I'm like always terrified if I get kidnapped, that bag over my head. I'm very claustrophobic. It's intense.
That sounds intense.
It's intense.
Where did you have that in Joburg? Does Joburg not count as hostile training?
No, actually it does. But actually, we have one of the best hostile environment training courses in this country.
Oh, really?
Yes, because we've got, you know, people who are only gung-ho to go and give that kind of training.
That's very true.
And you learn everything. We learned how that there was me and my producer, Sarah, these two women. We were changing, tires of a 4x4. Very useful, practical skills, actually. So we get the training. And then we get medical training as well. So we go on these medical courses because unfortunately, CBS, we had people who've died in Iraq, journalists. And, you know, just to be able to stop bleeding or help somebody enough to get them to hospital quickly enough.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is something. We get protection in some countries. We take our own. I was in Syria last year. You're not allowed to take anybody in there. So you just go. It's you, your producer, and the camera person, and you work with local fixers.
This is dangerous stuff.
It is.
Yeah, I had a sense of that. Even just most recently reading Andrew Harding's brilliant book, The Mayor of Mogadishu, you get a sense of what it is being in those kind of regions. Have you had that kind of training, Erin? Are you sipping cappuccinos in Melville in Joburg?
Yeah, well, there is that. But
right now we are, because there's not much
to do. At the moment, it's a bit... this is the issue. Well, I mean, I have a colleague based in Nairobi who's going to, you know, be doing more of the famine, but it's an incredibly important story. But, I mean, it is... sometimes a challenge to get attention to stories in Africa.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm fortunate at The Economist in that there's always a set number of pages for the Middle East in Africa, but it's the Middle East in Africa. Mm. So sometimes you're, you know, a South Africa story competing with what's happening in like Aleppo, for example, it can be a struggle to get things in. And so sometimes for me, it's a matter of picking and choosing when to weigh in on things. Like, for example, this year in South Africa, politics are fascinating, but I can't write about that every week.
Let's talk about our neighboring country, Zimbabwe. You are on Bob watch at the moment.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a perennial thing, you know, but Mugabe did just turn 93. I mean, people point out that his mother lived till she was, you know, 100, or is rumored to have done so.
Good genes.
Yeah, good genes. But it is something that you have to watch. I mean, he did look awfully tired and frail in his recent birthday interview. So it is something that's sort of constantly on our radar, but I think more so at the moment, in particular because he has done nothing to anoint a successor. And so I think it's a bit uncertain what will happen there at the moment.
In terms of the election of Trump that you mentioned, Deborah, I want us to talk a little bit about this. And I know that, Erin, you also are pretty passionate to reflect on what journalism will be like in a sort of Trump era. What are your reflections in terms of what's happening back in the States, the clampdown on the media? John Oliver made, you know, not John Oliver, what's his name? That Trevor took over from
John Stewart made a cameo
appearance, right? It was lovely. It was like just tough enough and stick to journalism. I mean, I love him so much that I chuckled. I watched it a couple of times on YouTube, but I'm not sure whether I actually agree with him. What are your thoughts? Is the space being closing down in terms of journalists having access as they ought to have, or should we just toughen up?
I think we should. I think that actually South Africa could offer lessons. We're used to dealing with majoritarian strongmen who kick us out of press conferences.
That's true.
We get called the opposition on bad days. We get called the CIA. We're used to this in South Africa, okay? This is what we know. And it's a more honest place to be as a journalist, I think, because you can't just cozy up and have... Unfortunately, that there's a strong tradition in America of the sort of presidential press corps. I don't know a lot about it, you know, just from what I understand from colleagues. And now you're not there anymore. So access is harder. But that gives you the chance to do better journalism because you have to work harder like we do in South Africa. We never have access to Jacob Zuma. He doesn't want to talk to the media. So you actually have to build up context and try and get the nitty-gritty of the story. They might find themselves in court a lot more. Because that's also what we do here. We have to go to court, and you have to be prepared to go to court, and that can get a bit exhausting, but it tests the principles on which you're based on. So I think it could be an exciting time. You're starting to see brave journalists emerging that perhaps we didn't know before. It's not to not be critical of what's happening there. And I understand why people are shocked, because they have a fine tradition that we like to emulate sometimes. But I think now this is perhaps an opportunity for us to share
experiences. Do you agree with Deborah?
I think it's a brilliant time for satire and late night TV in the US, but it is going to be a more challenging time for journalists, definitely. I think it is an opportunity to kind of step outside that Washington press corps bubble and report things a bit differently. At the same time, you know, the loss of access is a worrying development and a problem.
Let me read some of the tweets. Yashini says, "Eusebius, I'm loving the conversation with Erin and with Deborah." And Shlanchla goes further and says, "That's why we need CBS News on DSTV."
I'll tell them.
And just plenty of lots of love for this. That's great, because obviously there's pressure on them. They'll have to come back again. On the SMS line, yeah, some of them, Daryl says, great insights and discussion from your foreign correspondents. Really enjoying the perspective on our global standing. And another one here from Anonymous saying, I remember Chris McGreal decided to move on when the London News Desk phoned him to ask why he had not filed the story on rape insurance. And then the rest of that is actually missed. I'm not quite sure what they were getting at there. And let's take a call before we run out of time. Ntibeng, hello. Thank you so much for calling us.
Hello. Excellent show. I really like this segment. I think it's going to be brilliant just to get a global perspective and also an African perspective of, you know, of news in South Africa. Because I think we always, like Deborah said, hello, Deborah.
Hi there.
I used to work with you. How are you?
I'm great.
Oh. Yeah. Deborah used to be my boss at some stage at ETV.
Oh, you can tell stories.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Oh, no, I can just firstly say that I think you are a great journalist. And I just never be anybody's boss again, ever. So, you know, I like how what she said earlier about how, as journalists, we tend to view news in a very myopic point of view, because we just focus on South Africa. But I think just this segment, having foreign correspondents there, you know, give as an extension into what is happening into the continent in particular. And perhaps to a large extent, you know, when people get information, the sort of xenophobic outburst that we have in the country to a large extent can maybe dealt with, because now we have more information. I think we just don't have enough information. When you watch the news, you get about, what, a few minutes of what they call international news, and in there, there's hardly anything about the rest of Africa. And in the papers, they will get a segment, a page or so. In there, there's hardly anything about the rest of Africa. So this is brilliant, you see.
Okay, thanks so much for that. We've got 1 minute left. I'm going to give you 30 seconds each. What are you looking at over the next couple of days and weeks ahead? What's on your diary?
South Sudan, and we are globally, as foreign correspondents, looking at Trump's conflicts of interest around the globe.
Fantastic. Aaron?
I'm working on a political piece from South Africa. I think it's time to weigh back in on that, given what's been happening lately.
Absolutely. Guys, you've been fantastic. I think we're going to have to make this an hour, and I think we have officially talked ourselves into a new segment on the show. Thanks so much for coming in.